Okay, Exodus 20. We'll be reading from verse 1 all the way through to 21. And God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold any guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant or his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpets and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen. But do not let God speak to us or we will die. Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning. The people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. Welcome, Kyle, as he comes to preach.
Thank you. Well, good morning. It's great to be together. If you're visiting, my name's Kyle. I'm one of the pastors here at Jubilee. And we are in the second sermon in a series on the Ten Commandments. You may be thinking, why on earth would we take 10 weeks to look at the Ten Commandments? Well, there are a lot of reasons. I'll just give you two as we begin. The first is that the Ten Commandments are enormously influential. Perhaps no other ethical code has ever had a greater influence than the Ten Commandments. These words have shaped the world. Alan Dershowitz, who's a Harvard law professor, said that the Ten Commandments are a precursor to all Western law. Our understanding of social equality, of property rights, sexual ethics, the value of family, are all connected in some way by this remarkable text. So the Ten Commandments is extremely influential and has probably shaped how you think, whether you're aware of it or not. So if you're here this morning and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, you're still exploring Christianity or different faiths, hopefully this series will help you understand how profound and relevant these commands are. So they're influential in the world, but more than that, they are integral to Christianity. You see, these aren't just sort of 10 random rules that God kind of plucked out of the air. These offer a pathway into understanding ultimate reality. Now, I know that sounds like a bit of hyperbole, but these commands, this kind of body of text here, helps us understand who God is. As we seek to understand these commands, we get a glimpse into God's logic behind them, why he chose these 10 things to say, and what they reveal about who he is, who we are, and what we need. As we unpack them, we'll start to see the psychological, the social, and the spiritual realities that they correspond to. And the better we understand them, the better we can live by them, and the better we will flourish and grow. We've got to remember the context in which these commands were given. God had just rescued his people out of slavery. He had just set them free. But he wanted more than political freedom for them. He wanted spiritual freedom. He wanted psychological freedom. He wanted ethical flourishing. And so he speaks to them and gives them his word. So let's dig into the second commandment. Hopefully you have your Bible open. We'll look at it. As we approach the second commandment, it's worth just double-clicking on how we understand it, because what I realized as I was preparing for this is that God has actually connected the first two commandments. So let's look at both of them. Take a look at verse 3 and 4. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. Now, it may not be immediately obvious, but those two commands are inextricably connected. And the reason I say that is, if you look in verse 5, you'll notice that the word at the end is plural. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. But that can't be referring to the image in verse 4, because the image in verse 4 is singular. So it must be referring to the gods in verse 3, which is the first command. In other words, God is connected to the first two commands. And I think the point is this, that when you create a false image of God, which is the second command, you end up worshiping a false God. If you break the second commandment, you automatically break the first commandment. These two commands are kind of held together. So when you create an image that seeks to depict God, you end up creating a false God, an idol. So let's unpack how this works in stages. The first point I want to make is that false images of God misrepresent. False images of God always misrepresent him. And the reason is actually fairly simple. God is the infinite and invisible creator. Any depiction of him is necessarily finite. It's necessarily visible, it's material, it's local, and a created thing is never going to be able to represent its creator. It's necessarily always going to be smaller and therefore wrong. It's never going to be able to capture its creator. Now, for the Israelites, this was a radical idea. Every major religion in their world, in the ancient Near East, used images in order to worship God. The deity was sort of localized in the image. And the image sort of became the reference point for relating to the deity. And so when God says that they shouldn't make an image of him, it would have sounded absolutely shocking. You see, the images actually were designed to honor the gods. They weren't designed to minimize them. They were actually designed to highlight certain features of the gods. So for example, a very popular image would have been that of a young bull. Bulls, you know, if you're a rugby fan, you know the blobula. Bulls were often seen as symbols of power. So young bulls were a very popular choice. Eagles, a number of animals would have been used in order to kind of highlight maybe the power or the wisdom of a particular god. But the reason God prohibits them from making an image is that it will always be limited and skewed. Images of God will always represent him. One of the ways they do that is just by limiting who he really is in his fullness. So for example, even in the book of Exodus, we see that God reveals himself in a variety of ways. If you read from Exodus chapter 1, just up until this point, you'll realize that God reveals himself as a father. He reveals himself as a warrior. He reveals himself as a savior. These can't be captured by one image. And so an image will always misrepresent him. Well, it'd be easy to kind of think of these guys as being hopelessly unsophisticated and think, well, we'll never be guilty of breaking this command, so we can kind of take it easy this morning. This is one command that I'm sure we won't break. But it's helpful for us to consider what images of God we've created. Maybe not material images, but mental images. You see, we may break the second command by creating false images of God, not materially, but often mentally, in the way that we think about him. I think one of the signs that we are doing this is in this phrase, it comes across fairly often. People will say something like, well, that's not the God I believe in. The God I believe in, the God I know is an artist, and the world is his canvas. The God I know, the God I believe in is a God of love, a God of peace, a God of beauty. The God I believe in, the God I know wouldn't do that or wouldn't do this. Well, now some of those things may be true of God, but they're certainly not the whole picture. They certainly don't represent all that God is. And I think just as people in the ancient Near East would have materially created an image of God, I think people in Cape Town today mentally create images of God. Create an image of God that we like, a God that suits us, a God that affirms us, a God that always meets our needs and endorses our agenda. Is it possible that what often looks like spirituality is actually a form of projection? We end up making a God in our image. We project our ideals, our values, our psychology into our theology. And we end up creating a God that really is a reflection of us. And I think it's worth asking this morning, what image of God do I have? Who is God? If you had to summarize that to someone, if someone had to ask you, who is God? How would you answer? And would the picture you paint be a reflection of your psychology, or would it be a reflection of what the Bible says? Here's a little experiment, perhaps, a thought experiment to help you discern whether or not your image of God is accurate. Because I think we all think our image of God is accurate, hey? We all are fairly convinced that the way I think about God is accurate and comprehensive. Here's one little question, not the only question, one little test, rather. A false image of God will usually result in that God never contradicting you. The false image of God that we create always ends up endorsing us, always ends up affirming us. He never contradicts us. It's amazing. He's always agreeing with us. He's always affirming our plans and our desires. But he can never teach you. He can never contradict you. He can never rebuke you. No. So it's worth asking this morning, what image of God do I have? Have I created a mental image of God that is false? So the prohibition is there because false images of God misrepresent him. But another reason I think this prohibition is here is because images misrepresent the way we relate to God. Okay, they don't just represent who he is. They misrepresent the way we have relationship with him. Because when God builds relationship with his people, he doesn't do so through images. He does so through speech. God doesn't build relationship via visuals, but via voice. Okay? We relate to God by his Spirit through his word. Think about what's happening right now at Mount Sinai. This is kind of a climactic moment in the book of Exodus. They've been rescued out of Egypt, and God comes down on the mountain, but there's a big thick cloud. So they can't see God. I mean, they can see a cloud, but that's not God. God's not the cloud. So even when God is right there, he doesn't reveal an image to them. He comes on a cloud, and take a look at verse 1. What's he doing of chapter 20? He's speaking. God relates to people by his word. That's how God builds relationship. Words are far more effective at building relationship than images are. You can see there, I've got the Instagram symbol up, probably wondering what it's there for. Well, like many of you, I'm sure, I've got a lot of close friends and family that are in other parts of the world, other continents, other countries, and I want to make sure that I keep having a good relationship with them. And so I want to make sure that I'm talking to them. So that's the image of the phone. Now, talking to someone is a great way to keep developing the relationship. That's just a little tip, by the way. If your relationships are struggling, think about how much you're communicating and talking. Words are far more effective at building relationship than images are. Some of the people I'm close to, when I want to kind of chat with them over WhatsApp or Skype or something else, they'll say, we can do that, but just follow me on Instagram. You know, I'm posting images and you can kind of see what I'm up to. And, you know, that's cool. I'm not anti the Insta. But the problem with images is that they don't really tell you that much. I mean, they depict something, you know, he's having coffee, or he's eating a bagel, okay, this is great, and it's kind of got a nice shimmer to it, and but the image can't tell me much more. And in some ways, an image can also be misinterpreted. You know, why are they doing that? Don't they know that that's what we used to do together? Now they're doing it with someone else in some other part of the world. And it's so easy to misinterpret an image. An image really can't build relationship in the way that words can. You know, when you have a conversation with someone, you're really able to understand each other much better. If there's any misunderstandings that take place in a conversation, you can correct it. You can double-click on things. You can make sure you understand one another. Words are far more effective at building relationship than images are. If you don't believe me, just try and communicate in emojis only via WhatsApp and see how long that will work for. At some point, you'll realize this isn't sustainable. Words are far more effective at building relationship than images are. And God builds relationship with us, not through images, but through his word, through speaking. You see this again happening in Exodus. In chapter 34, Moses wants to see God. God actually agrees to that, but when God arrives, he comes again in a cloud. So, you know, you can't see him because he's in the cloud. But Moses ends up sort of spiritually seeing God by hearing his voice. God appears in the cloud and speaks to him. God always relates to his people through his word because it's a far more effective way of building relationship. How does your relationship with God work? What role does his word play in how you understand him, in how you respond to him? You see, it's a lot easier to scroll through Instagram than to actually have a conversation with someone. It takes quite a lot of emotional energy to have a really good conversation with someone. It would be so much easier to sort of have an image of God that you can look at and then carry on with your day, rather than reading his word, meditating on it, praying, wrestling with him, interceding for yourself or for others. Real relationship with God takes communication, takes emotional energy, takes work. And I think sometimes we're just a little bit lazy. Well, I know I am. It would be so much easier if I could just get a vision or an image. And I think even today, there's an unhealthy craving for visions and images. You know, every now and then a book or a movie will be released about a vision someone's had, or someone who died and went to heaven for half an hour or something like that. And it, of course, will become a bestseller. And I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a healthy sign that a relationship with God is going well. You know, it's so much easier. Just give me a picture. Tell me something. Rather than doing the hard work of relating to God through his word. But God has chosen to build relationship by speaking. He relates to us not through images, but through words. Does that describe your relationship with God? So false images misrepresent. They misrepresent God. They also misrepresent the way we relate to God. Secondly, false images distort. False images distort. And that's because we always become what we worship. The thing you worship will influence you. The image you worship will shape you. You will eventually resemble what you revere. Take a look again at verse 5. What happens with these images? You, verse 5, bow down to them or worship them. Now, the thing about worship in the Bible is that it's always transformative. That's one of the things worship does, is it transforms you, it changes you, it shapes you. And so if the thing you worship is false, it will introduce all kinds of distortions into your life, into your thinking, into your ethics, into your behavior. We actually see a very powerful example of this in the book of Exodus. Just a few chapters from now, in chapter 32, the Israelites will turn away from God. They'll reject the second commandment and the first commandment, and they'll create an image of God, an image of a young bull, a calf. In some ways, the golden calf story is a commentary on the first two commandments, but kind of like an anti-commentary, how not to obey them. You see, what happens is that Moses gives them the law in chapter 24. They promise they're going to obey it. And so Moses says, okay, I'm just going up the mountain to fetch it, because remember, God is going to write it down for them. While he's up on the mountain with the cloud of glory there, they get a little bit tired of waiting. Moses has put Aaron in charge. Aaron's sort of the associate pastor. They get tired of waiting for Moses, and so they say, you know what? It's very difficult to worship an invisible God. We're going to make a reference point for God. We're going to make a golden calf, a symbol of power even. And when they make it, Aaron then declares that they will hold a festival to the Lord. What's so surprising about this, and it kind of reveals the deceptive nature of idolatry, is that they weren't just slipping into a kind of completely different religion. They were saying, we are going to hold a festival to the Lord, but we're going to use the golden calf as our reference point. That's how we're going to relate to him. So they fashion it, they design it, and they say of the golden calf, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. And their religious festival turns into a debauched party. Everything goes wrong. It gets characterized by drinking, overeating, sexual immorality. When you read chapter 32, it might seem like that comes out of nowhere, but you've got to remember, you always resemble what you worship. You always become like what you worship. And so if you worship a young bull, you will start behaving like one. And actually, when God comes down and assesses the situation and describes their behavior, he uses kind of bovine imagery. He says they've turned away quickly from him. They've become stiff-necked. The behavior was chaotic and disorganized, just like young bulls running around out of control. You see, the thing you worship, the thing you value and invest your praise into and your energy into, ends up shaping you. It shapes you psychologically, it shapes you ethically, it shapes your relationships. False images of God always do that. They always distort. They always corrupt. They always end up impacting your thinking and your emotions and your behavior. And it can be a subtle process, right? They at least in theory, were claiming to still worship the Lord. They just thought this image would help them do it better. I want to improve my relationship with God. I'm going to introduce this element and it will help me worship him more effectively. Often we think we're worshiping the true God, but we've actually created an image of him that is false. And as I said, it may be a mental image. It's probably not a material image. But if your mental image of God is false, it will introduce all kinds of distortions into your life. It's easy for us to do this, any of us, to kind of have all kinds of ideas that perhaps come from our cultural moment imported into our theology that distorts our view of God,
And when we've got a false view of God, all these distortions flow into our lives because our view of God will shape us. Our view of God will determine who we become over time. Here's another kind of little way to think about whether this is happening. One way I think our deficient views of God get revealed is often seen in a kind of generational gap. So often sometimes young people think, oh, I can't believe my parents think God is like that. Or maybe kind of an older generation will look at a younger generation and go, oh, their view of God is slightly different and is a bit strange. That should be a little bit of an alarm bell for us, hey? Because we're all reading the same Bible. So of course it may be that one generation is more sensitive to certain aspects of God's character or perhaps particularly sensitive to certain attributes God has. But actually, that's why we need each other. That's why we need to have cross-generational conversations and relationships. One way we can also kind of mitigate against this is by reading people that have lived in different eras of church history. Really good to read Augustine or Martin Luther. Not because you're going to agree with everything people have said at different parts of history, but because our cultural moment can really influence our view of God and kind of shape it. The kind of zeitgeist of the age can creep into your theology and end up influencing your view of God. A.W. Tozer, in his book, The Knowledge of the Holy, said the following: what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. We tend by a secret law of the soul to move toward our mental image of God. Your view of God will determine the kind of person you become. Before moving on to our next point, it's just worth noting that idolatry encompasses, obviously, a false view of God, but it also encompasses anything that's replaced God. Maybe you're here this morning and you think, I'm not trying to create an image of God. I don't believe God exists. Well, an idol is potentially anything that has taken the place of God. The way you know you've got an idol in your life is by just thinking what the verbs bow down and worship relate to. Everyone bows down to something. Everyone sacrifices for something. Everyone worships something. And that thing will end up becoming what your life operates around. It will become your highest value. Everything else, every other value becomes subordinated to that thing. Maybe it's money. Maybe the highest value in your life is just securing enough money to feel safe. If money becomes an idol, if money becomes your functional God, it becomes the operating principle around which you organize everything. Maybe it's academic achievement or career advancement. If you build your life around that, it will introduce all kinds of distortions into your life. You'll overwork. You'll get burnout and exhaustion. Maybe it's your health or your physical attractiveness. If the idea of a perfect body becomes your highest value, again, that will introduce all kinds of distortions into your life and shape how you behave and live and relate to other people. Maybe it's relationships, the desire for approval and love. Maybe that's the most important thing to you. You'll do anything to be loved and valued. Again, you'll never be able to say no to anyone. You'll constantly give in to requests. You'll always do what others ask you to do. You'll be constantly worrying about what's happening on all your different social media sites, how many people are following you and liking you and what they're saying about you. You'll be riddled with that kind of anxiety. So it's worth thinking about what it is we're devoted to, what our view of God is, or what's taking the place of God in our lives. Because the thing we're devoted to will shape us. We always become what we worship. We always resemble what we revere. And false images distort. Any false view of God or an idol that's replaced God will bring distortions into our lives. So this command is given to us because false images misrepresent God. False images bring distortions into our lives. Lastly, false images provoke. They provoke God. Take a look at verse 5 again. Here we're given the reason. Why shouldn't we do this? Why shouldn't we bow down or worship false images? Verse 5, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Idolatry provokes God's wrath because what he wants is an exclusive relationship. Just as a husband wants the exclusive allegiance of his wife, so God wants the exclusive love of his people. God is jealous for that. God is zealous for that. Now you might think, well, is it really right for God to be jealous? Isn't that a little bit egocentric? You know, can't he just share with other gods or other things? Why does he need to occupy the number one spot? Well, two reasons, I think. The first is that it's right for God to occupy the highest spot because he's our creator. If God is the creator, then it's right that we give him credit where credit is due. It's right that we honor him as creator, that we honor him appropriately. It's not right to do that to people because they're created. But the creator is the source, sustenance, and purpose of creation. It's only right and fitting that he occupies the number one spot. It's actually ethical that we give him our exclusive allegiance. So it's right, but it's also loving. Because remember what idolatry does. Idolatry distorts. And because God is a God of love, and because he actually wants what's best for us, when we worship idols, we get dehumanized. All kinds of distortions come into our souls and into our lives. And because God loves us, he wants to rescue us from that. And by insisting that we worship him alone, he is also securing our healing. Because it's when we worship him that we're renewed and transformed. Idolatry always deforms. True worship always reforms and renews. Sadly, though, we aren't always devoted to God. We see that throughout the book of Exodus. We see that throughout the Bible. And we realize that actually we have provoked God. We actually do deserve his wrath. We stand under his judgment. Did you notice in verse 5, to worship another God is to hate the true God. When he talks about punishing people, by the way, when he talks about punishing the children for the sin of the parents, it's a Hebrew idiom for saying he punishes the generations for their sin. And typically, idolatry has consequences. The next generation learns the idolatry of the previous generation. And God is saying he will punish the next generation. He'll punish the children for their idolatry just as he punished the parents for their idolatry. And to commit idolatry is, verse 5, to hate God. And yet, although we know we're going to break this command, it ends with the meditation on God's love. Did you see that, verse 6? He shows love to 1,000 generations. And so that's the riddle. How can God show love to people who hate him? How can that happen? Because God's wrath is right. God's judgment is just. We've offended God. We've dehumanized ourselves in the process. We've broken his law. And the question is, how can he love people who've hated him? The Bible's answer to that is as simple as it is stunning. We create false images of God. He responds by sending us a true image of himself. And where false images distort, the true image restores. The true image restores. John chapter 1, verse 18. No one's ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. God sends Jesus Jesus is the true image of God. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3, the Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. What the New Testament is teaching us is that Jesus is the image of God. Jesus is the exact representation of God. If you want to see an image of God, look to Christ. If you want to know what God is like, look to Jesus. If you want to worship God, worship Christ. More than that, Hebrews 1:3 tells us that Jesus not only perfectly reveals the Father, but Jesus provides purification for sin, which is exactly what we need, isn't it? Because we've created false images. We've fallen into idolatry. We've broken the first two commandments. And if we're honest, the other eight as well. But when Jesus died on the cross, he took our place. He took God's wrath for us. He was punished so that we might be forgiven and purified. Jesus dealt with our sin and our guilt. He offers us forgiveness and by his Spirit enables us to worship him. And because you become what you worship, when you worship Jesus, you become like him. All the distortions that came into your life through idolatry are reversed when you start to worship Christ. The image of God that was defaced in us through our idolatry is restored in us when we worship Jesus. So when we are devoted to Christ, we experience healing, we experience renewal, we experience transformation. True worship always purifies. So as you reflect on the second commandment, we mustn't just reflect on what we shouldn't do, not just on how we shouldn't create a false image. We should think about how God has sent us a true image of himself, how God has sent us his very own image in his Son. Because it's as we look to Jesus, it's as we trust in his death, it's as we worship him with our hearts that we will experience forgiveness, healing, and restoration.